And away we go. Here we are, Tuesday, November the 26th, 2019, 15 coming up on 16 minutes past the hour, 48 hours away from the big Turkey Day celebration. Can you smell the turkey? Can you smell the sweet potatoes? Can you smell the pumpkin pie? Well, I hope you can, and I hope you're here with us today. We're going to get right into the show this morning because we have got a tremendous two-hour broadcast. Now, we have been blessed by the talk show gods in the last 2 weeks. We have had a tremendous slate of guests, not even in a two-week period, really in about the last 8 days. Ed Asner was on last Monday, Lou Grant from Mary Tyler Moore, who just turned 90 years old. We had David Newell, Mr. McFeely from the original Mr. Rogers Neighborhood with the big Mr. Rogers movie with Tom Hanks opening up last weekend. We had Ashley Williams, who was on the Holiday Hearts Hallmark movie. We had Pat Carroll, the voice of Ursula in The Little Mermaid, talking about 30 years of The Little Mermaid and the Disney Plus series. We had legendary comedian Shecky Green on yesterday with a little holiday visit. And today, we're going to top all that because we have one of the true legends of the business that I'm in broadcasting. He is one of the funniest, most talented men you will ever want to meet. He was kind enough to visit with us back in August, I believe it was, and over my radio career, he has visited with us quite a few times, going way back to his last show on WLW, which I think has been more than 12 years ago. He was and is an institution for many people in this country. What a pleasure to have on at holiday time the man who is responsible for Earl Pitts and so many other great characters, the legendary, the talented, and I use this word very sparsely, but it fits right here, Gary Burbank. Gary, happy holidays.
Well, I wasn't sure you were talking about me till you said Earl Pitts. you had Ed Asner on. I've got a story later to tell you about Ed Asner.
Well, we'll mark that down.
I met him, yeah, and it's very funny.
You know, Ed came to our town here about 7 years ago, so I can imagine, because I've spent some behind-the-scenes stories with Ed myself.
Yeah, okay.
An interesting
well, I'll tell you now, if we got time?
Go right ahead.
Well, it was Marconi Award time, you know, I think it was in L.A. or San Francisco, one of the two. And so I was up for one, and everybody that was accepting went up, and you know how these shows start to drag. They were thanking their mothers and their fathers and their goldfish and naming each goldfish, you know, that kind of stuff. It just went on forever. And people were really, and Dick Clark was the MC. He was trying to move it along, and just nothing was working. And I went back to get a drink, and I got in line behind. I looked, this is Ed Asner. It just blew me away. And of course, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to bug him. And so as I'm standing there, I realize he's trying to buy the whole bottle of Jim Beam from the guy. He didn't want just a drink. And they're arguing. And so I got in, and I said, "Why don't you just sell him your bottle? You're going to sell it anyway." And he said, "I guess so." And then, you know, "How many drinks are in a bottle?" And I rattled off a number. And he says, "Okay." And so Ed Asner turned and looked at me, and he said, "Are you going to win anything? You know, just like Lou Grant." And I said, "I might, yeah." He goes, "Well, do me a favor and keep it short." And I said, "Okay, if I do, I will." So I get you know, back to my table after about a half an hour of people thanking, you know, everybody they ever knew. They announced me, and I was the winner of the Marconi. So I get up and I go on stage, and as I'm walking to the microphone, I'm looking out and I can see him. And he's just looking at me just like, "You better." And I just got into the microphone and said, "Thank you," and turned around and walked off. The place went wild. And Dick Clark came out and said, "We got to get Gary to win more awards." And Ed Asner, held his hand up going, yes, to get a fist up. You know, I kept it really short. He's a heck of a nice guy.
Well, you know, I'm going to just take a little time, because this is one of my favorite Ed Asner stories, and he got me in trouble. I always say Ed Asner got me in trouble with the mayor here in our town.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. What he did was, I was presenting him with a proclamation, or I was presenting him with an award at an award show, and the mayor had sent over a proclamation, which mayors normally do, but the mayor himself could not be there that night. So I get up to present this award, and I end up reading the mayor's proclamation. And then I go off stage. And in the wing, a lot of times, you can't hear what the person is saying up on stage. So Ed gets up to get the award, and all of a sudden, I hear this burst of huge laughter, but I don't know what Ed said. So I go back out. I go back out after Ed's done, and I have no idea what he said, so I just kept on going with the show. And then about 2 weeks later, the mayor called me down to his office. And I thought, well, what in the world does the mayor want to talk about? So I go down to the mayor's office, and apparently he had gotten word that after I read the proclamation and gave Ed the award, that Ed got up to the podium and said, well, if the mayor can't show up and present this to me himself, then he can take this award and stick it in a place that I can't say on the radio.
That's great. Yeah, but, well, you know what? He's just being Lou Grant.
That was a good character for him.
Yeah,
that fit
now
him.
That we know him a little better, we realize that he wasn't acting at all.
No, that was definitely not typecasting. That was just casting.
Yeah.
Well, Gary, here we are in the full swing of the holiday seasons. I know it's a very busy time for you. What's this time of year mean for you?
It's a family. I guess I'm a little out of breath here. I have a little COPD, and I run out of breath, and all of a sudden I have a rescue inhaler. But and family, and getting together with family, and where it seems to, you know, take an act of Congress to, you know, for us all to get together. And but when Thanksgiving rolls around and Christmas, of course, you know, we're there.
Well, I tell you, Gary, I'm going to let you catch your breath here for a second, because we have a classic Earl Pitts to play this morning.
Oh, cool.
We do.
I'll run over and get my inhaler.
Yeah. So just take a break here, and we'll play this classic for 2 minutes, and we'll come back with Gary Burbank.
I'll be right here.
Here we are. This Earl Pitts is a classic Thanksgiving Earl Pitts from November 22nd, 2013. This is Earl Pitts on Shopping on Thanksgiving. Oh, what will Earl say? Here we go.
You know what makes me sick? You know what makes me so mad? I won't jam a bunch of BBs up my nose and then go see if I can sneeze me a couple of dead pigeons. I got a simple question. Does tradition mean anything anymore? Here we are, as Americans, totally lost. We have lost our bearings. I'm talking, of course, about the tradition on Thanksgiving Day, about families gathering together, eating a 30-pound turkey, and then laying around popping roll age and groaning and watching the NFL. Did you notice I didn't say nothing about shopping? That's because shopping is a day after Thanksgiving, otherwise known as Black Friday. Only a bunch of these greedy money grubber pinhead business people have decided Black Friday ain't soon enough to lure women out of the house. They now plan to open their stores on Thanksgiving Day. This idiotic idea is about to upset the balance of nature in ways we can't even imagine. It also raises some very important questions. For example, are we about to turn a solemn American traditional day of union and family togetherness into just another crass commercial excuse to buy stuff? Will it ultimately all lead to the wiping out of other important communal and sacred bonding celebrations like Christmas, Easter, or Richard Petty's birthday? And most important of all, if our old ladies take off for the mall right after we finish eating, does that mean we're expected to wash the dishes? Or worse yet, go to the fridge and get our own beer? Wake up, America! Fact is, the way I see it, shopping on Thanksgiving is worse than crying at the movies or mud flaps on a moped. I'm Earl Pitsamurk. If you want to hear this again, go to pitsoff.com. Pits off.
A classic Thanksgiving Earl Pitts from November 22nd, 2013. And boy, they've gone crazy with the shopping now. We're joined by the creator, voice, and personality of the legendary Earl Pitts, Gary Burbank. Gary, boy, that still holds true today, doesn't it?
You know, I was listening. Yeah, it really does. I was listening to that, and it was kind of funny because that voice I'm doing now, it's different than when I first started doing Earl. When I first started doing Earl, I was talking more like this. And all of a sudden he became angrier, you know? And I guess it worked.
Well, you know what's interesting? I was thinking about this the other day, and not to get into the whole political thing, but years before we talked about this certain group of voters who vote a certain way, Earl Pitts was a little bit of the prototype for that.
Yeah, Earl was more like, well, everybody was getting mad at me because Earl didn't like Trump that much. Well, Earl is running against Trump, and he always accused Trump of stealing his act. And everybody got really upset until he finally, you know, kind of I figured it out. Is if Earl says something good about you, that's not good because Earl's usually wrong-headed.
Well, the funny thing was, the last time we talked, the thing that I found most interesting was, because I really had never heard you say this before, that you created Earl to be kind of like an Archie Bunker, that people would laugh at him, not with him. But
right, yeah.
But people do laugh with him. People,
oh, believe me. I mean, I get, you know, when you say something really outrageously insane, that's right, you know. And I go, oh, really? Thank you. And that's all I say. I'm not going to straighten anybody out. It's not my job. It's not my job.
When the political times that we're in right now, I mean, boy, we've got everything going on. We've got a little touch of everything, and nobody gets along anymore. You used to be able to talk about politicians without the roof caving in on you.
I would never have been able to do the kind of show that I did then. Back when I was doing it, because we did, you know, Press the Face of the Nation, and we did, you know, telephone calls. I did the, you know, usually a president's voice or whatever, and did a lot of political satire. Well, today that would be taken seriously, but it wasn't on one side. I need material, so whoever did anybody, I don't care, Republican, Democrat, Independent, whoever. Says something stupid one day, then I'm going to parody that probably the next day. But then people get upset with you, the person on the air. That day, they're mad at you and will never listen again. And then tomorrow, they hear you doing the other guy. Or woman, you know. And so it's just, I don't think you could do a show like that. People don't have the temperament to be able to listen to something that they disagree with without screaming.
Well, this brings up an interesting point, Gary, because on your show on WLW for so many years, there were so many great characters, certainly other than Earl Pitts, but it seemed like you really liked to satire politicians, but also really loved to satire newscasters or people who worked in the journalism
business. Exactly, exactly. You know, whenever we went to... We'd fake interruption, and we're going to for some kind of report. You know how you hear the reporters all talking in a room before the gavel bangs on whatever, you know. But we were always saying, you know, when it came time for question time, we'd all start yelling, I want to hear my voice. I want to hear my voice. I want to hear my voice. And just little things like that. And we did satirize a lot of what was going on. And basically, I hear today people say, well, the media's left or right. I don't think the media's left or right at all. The media has become a little too sensational. Everybody, they've been given too much material is what it is. And they're trying to get it all in. And I don't know. It just It would be hard today. You're right. Exactly, Scott. It wouldn't work.
You know what's interesting? All the years I've been in radio, and you certainly top that record by many years, but it's interesting. Nobody has ever come to me and said, report this story, report that story, use this slant, use that slant. So I'm never really sure about this liberal media thing. I don't know where that comes from.
Well, you know what? It comes from people trying to find someone to blame, and it works the other way around too. I think that me, no one ever told me, 50 years in radio, almost, I think, but like no one ever told me that I had to, you know, lean on one side for a certain politician or not. I'll be honest with you. I am a Democrat, but I don't always vote Democrat. I'm more of a middle of the road, you know. And I'm that because my mother and father were, and their parents were, you know. We're from the South, and that's Democrats used to be Republicans, and Republicans used to be Democrats. I'm confused about what the heck I am, but if someone strikes me that they're truthful, I'll tell you a good story. Brad Winstrup. He's a congressman, and he called me one day when he was running against Ms. Schmidt, Jane Schmidt, I think her name is Jane. But he asked me if I would do some call-outs as Earl Pitts for him. Well, he's a really good friend of mine, and a Republican. And we kid each other a whole lot. We'd be sitting there, and he's quoting books and or articles about something to dash my opinion, and I'm doing the same with him, except one thing. He finally figured out I was making up my articles. But this story is kind of funny. He asked me to do that, and I said, sure, man, I'll do that for you. And I did. And about a year later, he called me, and he said, guess what? He said, the conference is over. They had a big awards ceremony for the best call-out, best commercial, this and that, in Seattle. And he said, guess who won best call-out in the nation? I said, oh, no. He said, now, do I take this plaque and put it in my closet or give it to you so you can put it in your closet? And if it had been a Democrat, I'd have put it in my closet, too.
Well, that said, I think with you doing the type of show that you did, a creatively funny show, if it's funny, it's funny.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of hoping people would. But people are different now. I've noticed, you know, like on the social media. I mean, and we played a little game, Duke and I, my friend, who was my co-host for the last couple of years I was on the air. We played, it was called Idiocracy. Did you see the movie by any chance?
I did.
I think that movie was, I mean, I think it was panned horribly by everyone for saying Idiocracy is just sophomoric humor. Well, it was about sophomoric things that were, the president of the United States was a wrestler, you know. I can't go into exactly some of the other things on the air here that were in there, but we call it Idiocracy. We would pick somebody and then go online with them and be stupider than they were. But people got mad at me. And I'm going, I couldn't tell them what I was doing, so I had to stop doing that.
Well, you know, this comes to an interesting question, Gary, because all the years that you did your show was a comedy show that was actually written, planned out by the day's events. Now, I don't know if this exists anywhere. I don't know if it existed at the time that you went off the air 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. Give me a typical day of planning a Gary Burbank WLW afternoon show.
Well, first thing I do is get a cup of coffee, sit down with a tablet at the kitchen table. I don't have an office. So, you know, sit at the kitchen table, and then Carol would wake up, and then she would come in and start talking to me, and I would say, hey, don't talk to me. I've got to write. And she would hump and walk out of the room. And she's had to put up with an awful lot. But that was me trying to write my part of it, and or concepts, and you know, just whatever came to mind that might be usable. And then the best part of it was, I don't know where they came from, out of the woodwork. These guys were comedy writers. Ken Levine of MASH, the head writer on MASH, told me once that he said you could take your crew out to L.A. You guys would find work immediately. He said these guys are fantastic. I thought, I know, and I didn't write everything on my show. Someone would call me with an idea, and I might write it. But I can't list everybody, but you know, I'd say five or six people that almost every day would turn in a piece, and I would pay them for it. But like, they were, I guess, closet comedy writers. One is Jim Probasco is in Dayton, and he was a high school band director there. And one was an accountant. They all had regular jobs, and they weren't about to quit everything and go to L.A. and become a comedy writer. But each of them, John Bunyan, I was named the funniest man in Cincinnati about 5 years ago. And he decided to be a stand-up comic. But he still got his job he's an accountant, yeah. So, I'm trying to give you the day. So what I would get, what I had, I would rewrite, maybe add a line here. I became an editor after a while. And then we'd go in to the station, get there about 10, 10:30, something like that in the morning. Usually, I think the people that do afternoon drive now, and they do a different kind of show, so they don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. They get in, 2 minutes before three, and then they go on air as soon as the newscast is over. That's a talk show. I'm sure there's some prep going on. Yeah, they have to know things and all that, and I think they're very good at it. And however, we worked like crazy. Back in the days of tape, we'd sit down and make, splice for an hour and edit, the bits all together and take out the curse words and things like that. That right in the middle of it, when you messed up, you said something. And so then we call that production. And then at 3 o'clock, it was time to go on the air. Well, then of course, you've got, 3 hours of all of that mess. And then when that was over, that's it. That was my day.
When you are doing a show like that, unlike a stand-up comedian or unlike somebody who maybe is doing a sitcom in front of a live audience, you know it's funny because of the audience's reaction. But when you're in a radio studio and doing something, how do you know that it's funny?
You don't. you laugh. And when you hear it coming back at you, most of the bits that we did, there was interaction. There was some, weren't like the big fat balding guy with a stubby cigar in his mouth and his pants half zipped. That had to be fully, all on there, And what was the question?
How do you know it's funny?
I haven't had any coffee yet.
That's okay. How do you know when it's funny in a radio studio?
You just inherently know, or you think it's funny. There's been a lot of things I thought were funny that as soon as it came up, on the air, I'd say it, and then Doc would just look at me. Oh! And so then I'd find out it wasn't that funny. But you do a lot of material. I mean, we did more, but somebody wrote an article, said we did more material in a week than a stand-up does in his life. And that's probably true. Some of it is true anyway. It's just a lot of material, and it goes, you do it one time, it's over.
Mm-hmm. It was a tremendous amount of material, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, trying to make people laugh. Did you ever feel like the well had just run dry sometimes and it was
going? Oh, yeah. Usually every other day. Yeah. when you sit down to write, it's just, I can't think of anything. And then when you give up and I can't think of anything, and you go take a slug of Jim Beam, then suddenly you think of something. I'm only kidding. You don't do that because that's the worst thing you can do.
How much of the show was absolutely off the script, and how often were you able to veer off from the script?
You know, actually, a lot of the show I veered off the script. I was usually like Gilbert Gnarly. Gilbert Gnarly calling about KY jelly, calling it Kentucky jelly, and how it had a neutral taste on toast. It was a very funny piece, but I don't know where the idea came from. I think I did, but I think somebody may have told me that somewhere. And so I take it, I make the phone call, but I did do an outline of where I was going. You know, not written out, maybe one word, just so, you know, to take me here. And then it would always depend upon the reaction of the person I'm calling. If they were, you know, into it, it made it work really well. If they weren't, sometimes that didn't even work well. Excuse me. The Christmas toy list. Every year we do these ridiculous Christmas toys, and person, the lady on the phone, just she wouldn't talk. She'd go, you know, "Do you have?" And he'd go into the toy, and she'd go, "No." And then she just said no for like 6 or 7 minutes, but she stayed with me, and so that, you know, I didn't take off anywhere. Then I just kind of ad libbed my way through it, and then you're kind of, and it's easy, you know. I had already outlined where I was going, and so I just go in that direction. There are other times, like I called about he was going to buy a trailer, and they'd ask him about tongue weight. Well, of course, Gilbert is trying to weigh his tongue that night, and he realizes that his tongue weighs the same no matter what, and so he finally. I forgot what I did. I thought of a way that he would really weigh his tongue, and the guy just, you know, that was trying to explain it to me what tongue weight was. Was just, he was wonderful. He was serious with Joe. He's trying to help him, and that worked well. And so I didn't worry about, you know, getting off of script, because, you know, Eunice and Bernice, the Siamese twins, joined together at the telephone. The reason you never hear them on tape or any of my CDs or anything is because that was a bit that was done on the air. I know that there were two old ladies talking at the same time, and one was doing a harmony part, actually, with the other one, and as they talked. And so then I went on the air, answer, you know. Well, I couldn't go anywhere because, you know, it's already been done, so I had to basically stick with the script. And I never wrote my answers down, you know, and sometimes they would be funny, sometimes they wouldn't. And that's kind of how that one worked. So it's hard to say, because we were always veering off script. Now, the Earl, no. I mean, I recorded that, and then I would usually play it on the air, or I would do it live on the air. I would stick mostly to script. Let me see. Big Fat Balling Guy was sort of like, that had to be done beforehand. There was no deviating from script. However, Howlin' Blind Muddy Slim, your 60-minute Jelly Belly Toe Jam Man, was he was a caricature of Jimmy Reed. Remember the song Big Boss Man? Can't you hear me when I call?
I do.
Okay. Well, I played drums behind Jimmy a couple times. The first time. Well, this story is a little, yeah, I think I can tell it. Jimmy Reed was, and his son, Junior, we were playing a place called, I think it was the Cadillac Club in Memphis, Tennessee. And I had never met him before. They needed a bass player and a drummer, and the agent sent me and this other guy out there, and I'm sitting behind the drums. And Jimmy Reed walks up to me. No, before he walks up, I was outside, and that's how I met him when they pulled up. And I'm terrible at telling a story these days. So his manager told me, he said, "Don't give him anything to drink." I said, "Man, I think you're too late." He said, "No, that's just residual." I said, "Okay." And so then we go in to do a sound check, you know. And so I'm sitting behind the drums, and Jimmy Reed walks up to me and said, "You the drummer?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he put his hand on my hi-hat, and he said, "You can hit this?" I said, "Okay." And he put his hand on my snare and said, "You can hit that." Mm-hmm. And he pointed toward my bass drum and said, "Hey, you can kick that." Mm-hmm. "If you touch another one of these drums, I'm going to bust you upside your blankety-blankety-blank head with this blankety-blank guitar." I said, "Yes, sir." And so we played, and we did the show and all, and it turned out great. You know, I got to play with Jimmy Reed. So we couldn't find him when the show was over. And nobody could, you know, we were looking all over the place. I was waiting to get paid. And so we all started looking for him. The place had tablecloths, and it was a big place. And so I am the one who found him. I lifted a tablecloth, got him in a corner. And he was under the table, and he had taken all of the shots of whatever that people got, and they were all sitting, and he mixed them together and stuff, and off the tables. And he was, I mean, he couldn't move. He was just totally out of it. And I looked at him, and about that time the bass player came by, and I looked at him, and we both looked at each other, and I said, "Someday, by the grace of God, this will be me when I make it big." And that's not just, so that character became Howlin' Blind Muddy Slim, your 60-minute Jetty Betty Toe Jam Man. "Gonna learn you some blues on Blues Break 201," and that was totally ad lib. Now, and I won't say that I wrote out, you know, what I was going to do, some of the stuff, but you know, just to remind me.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I think about celebrities, when you talk about Ed Asner and you talk about the story, Mr. Reed there, who had an interesting time.
Oh, he was great.
Yeah, who was your favorite celebrity, either guest or run-in in your career?
Man, it's too hard. Let's see, favorite celebrity. Well, Randy, I'll tell you one pretty funny story, too. It wasn't my favorite celebrity, but I liked her a lot. She was a wonderful person. Was, I can't think of her name now. I'm sorry, Brenda Lee, right?
Yeah.
Okay. My brain is about gone, by the way. As I get older, I can't remember where you put your socks. Oh, your feet. Yeah, I have them on my ears. Sorry. And so Brenda Lee, Jim Scott, who did mornings at LW, started a rumor that I was married to Brenda Lee at one point in my life. And I was like, you know, I didn't deny it. Because that would be giving in, you know. I just say yeah, and so it became kind of everyone I knew thought that I was married to Brenda Lee at one point, you know, and then she came to town for some show, and guess whose show she came on to promote it was mine. So I'm thinking, now how am I going to handle this? I'll just, you know, I'll just talk to her, and I did. I came in when she. I would say things like, you know, it's wonderful the way we can get along now. We had a hard time, you know, but like, we get along great now. And she'd look at me real funny and go, yeah. And I would throw in stuff like that. And, like, you know, like we had been married before, but you know, but never to the point of where she knew what I was talking about. She just thought I was a little weird, but I am. And, so anyway, she comes around, hugs me when she leaves. She's as sweet as she could be, and she left. And everybody then thought, you know, well, he must have been married to Brenda Lee.
That is a great story.
Yeah, but she wasn't my favorite celebrity. George Carlin.
Oh,
George Carlin. When I was at CKLW in Detroit. George Carlin, they were supposed to send a car for him, and they didn't. When I got off, he was just kind of standing there. I said, "You want to get a cup of coffee or something?" You know, and that was 9 o'clock. I got off here at 9 o'clock. I did mornings there. So we went back, and we just had a good time talking about things, and I liked him. He was a nice guy. And then I saw him another time somewhere else, and he remembered me. And then he meets a lot of people. And then in Louisville is where it was. He was doing a show in Louisville, so I went there, and I was going to bring him on, and so I went back to, he was back in the green room. I guess it was a green room. It was a table and a chair and maybe two chairs. So I went back there, and he said, "Gary, yeah, you know where I get some Coke?" And I said, "Yeah." And I reached around, and there was a cooler there. I said, "Well, there's no Coke. There's some Sprite." And he looked at me with his face, and I went, "Oh, that." And so then any time, and I saw him quite a few times after that, you know, we even hung out a little bit. After that, he said, to start every show, he would go, "Folks, let's talk about how hip Gary Burbank is."
That
I'm
is...
like, all right, you know, I knew what it was, but I didn't know, you know, I didn't know that's what he was talking about. So
that is the funny.
But
story.
I guess he was probably one of my favorites. Yeah.
Well, and then we all know who do this for many years that there are those celebrities who you are excited to see, and then you realize who those celebrities are. Was there a least favorite encounter?
A least favorite? No, not really. Not really. I really can't say that there was somebody that. I don't know if it was Gene Simmons, because I can't tell Kiss apart, but like, we were backstage. I was there with Bob Moody. I don't know if you know Bob. He's you know, been in radio 1,000 years, but one of them reached over and tapped his girlfriend on the back end. Moody's about 6'10", and this guy's got the big, you know, heels on, and he still only comes up to Moody's chin. Moody didn't grab him or anything, but he got in his face and said, "We don't do that kind of crap where I'm from, buddy." And he's going, I'm sorry. And so maybe I, you know, but they were nice, though. I mean, I can't say that they weren't. It's usually the bands that are just making it big that give you the most trouble. I had a problem in Louisville once. I was bringing on, I think the band was called Madras or something. They had a mediocre hit out at the time. And I was supposed to bring them on. I was standing there, you know, backstage. And the stage, I guess, one of their guys, that group, not a group, he would have been a sound man. Not a sound, what do you call him? Anyway, he, you know, put things together for the band. He was a stage manager, I guess. And he said, "You've got," it puts his finger in my face and says, "You've got, 30 seconds. And I said, "Let me tell you, pal, it's as big a thrill for me to bring you on as it is for you to have me bring you on. So, you know, I don't even have to do it." And I wasn't going to. And then the guy that was running, that put the concert on, listen to that talk, but the guy, the concert promoter, came over to me and said, "How about you get going up and just bringing him on?" I said, "Okay, I'll do that." And so I thought, you know, the guy could be having a really tough time, a bad day, so maybe that's why he was kind of, you know, strong with me and pointing his finger in my face. And so I walked by him as I went on, I said, "I'll keep it short." That's what I said to him, and he said something nasty. And I thought, man, that is just nasty. So I just walked out. Boom, microphone comes on. I said, "Here's a band," and turned around and walked off. He's like, "Whoa." And the guitar player started, and then they had to start over again.
Oh, that's funny.
And so I got him back.
That it's beautiful moments like that I think we all that stick with us through the years. 54 minutes past the hour, we're chatting with the legendary Gary Burbank here. Got about 6 minutes left with him, and that's never enough time. And by the way, I think this is true, that Earl Pitts is the longest-running syndicated comedy radio show in the history of radio, still running, by the way, and that's all from Gary Burbank. Gary, thank goodness you're still with us, and will be with us for many years, but is there a contingency plan? If something would ever happen, where
I'd die. my contingency plan is to drop it. Otherwise, I'll just eat and drink and party.
Are there many Earl Socked Away that you have recorded that would air for years to come?
Well, I'll tell you what I've done is, and my daughter is a professor at Northern Kentucky University. She's an electronic media professor. I just figured that out not too long ago. And she is putting together a podcast, and she's got all of my, I didn't know that all my stuff was on a hard drive. I thought it was on tape and stuff like that. I wouldn't dare try to, fish that out of there. And so she's put it all together, and I've got, let's see, 8-hour-long shows. That's like 8 comedy albums. I mean, when you're doing comedy, yeah, time goes by fast. How much have I got? They got 12 minutes, and you think you had 42. And so anyway, but we got it done. I've got 10 shows because I got writers in the round. I wanted to get these guys that write with me some credit on there too. And so we're just gonna do it, and I give maybe any food to make any money goes to charity or something like that.
Oh, that's great. And these will be out sometime in the new year.
If I get everybody off their butts to do it.
Gotta get
them. We've actually got them put together. I just need to go through and see where I need to interject myself or Doc. And Doc's busy, so we're dealing with a lot of people.
Yeah, but I can understand it. Well, that'll be something to look forward to in the future. Gary, when you hung it up at WLW, I know so many people were shocked. I remember when you announced it back in 2007, people were unbelievably shocked, and it was a big deal. A matter of fact, there was a gentleman who called the radio station I was working at that time and said, "Did you know Gary Burbank is retiring? You've got to get him on your show." And very kindly, you did come on and do the show, I think a couple days before your last show. But did you expect it to be that big of a deal?
Probably not. I didn't think so. I was 66 years old, and I had plans to retire at 40. And being 66, I thought, it's time for me to go. And things were changing in radio. It was more angry white guys, and the angry white guys in the station didn't think I was very funny. It's okay. They had a different kind of act going, and I understand that. And so I was happy to go. I think like Peter the Buzzer said, time is up. My time was up, and I'm okay with that.
It's an interesting thing because that is kind of where radio is now. If you turn, even here in our community, the longest station in the community, which has been on the air 80 years, recently, this past summer, automated to pretty well what you just said, the angry white guy attitude. Those guys, because I've often wondered about this, do you think that's an act? Is that a show? How much show's involved in that?
All of it.
All of it.
Yeah. I mean, do they really believe? Maybe they do. Maybe they do. And it was a ratings grabber. So you can't blame anybody for going for that. I think all of it is not an act. It's they really feel that way. I think they do. I think they actually. I mean, Ted Webb down in Tampa, one of my best buddies. We'd never get into an argument about anything because we keep it. When he's on the air, I can disagree with him in the car and listening to him and shake my finger and say that's wrong. There was just angry. That's what we call them, angry white guys.
It's interesting. We have, and certainly he's still around, Howard Stern's out there. He's on Sirius. People like Bob and Tom are around. They're popular. And then
they're great. Yeah,
absolutely. But it basically, as we have said, it is the syndicated group of people who have become very, very big. Why do you think that has taken over AM radio, that's the audience that pushed Larry King, Tom Snyder, people who did talk shows like this one on AM, those shows really pushed them out of the way?
Paul Harvey, But Paul, well, Paul died, and that's why he's not on the air, by the way. He'd been going today, I think. I don't know. That's a hard question. I really don't know. I know that, you know, when deregulation hit, then it seemed that the big, huge corporations came in. And I'll give you a – this really happened. And a friend of mine was making $1 million a year. That's a lot of money. Yeah. And you won't find that happening anymore, because they bought the show. They looked and saw how much money he made, and said, "Okay, do not renew his contract." And we're not going to be paying that kind of money. And okay, so they bring in someone else. But this guy was great on the air. I mean, he was like, I mean, had a huge audience. Well, the audience disappeared, and then the corporate heads, you know, are looking at the money that's coming in, say, what happened to that money? Well, you got rid of the guy that made you that money, the guy that compelled people to listen. And that's what it's really all about. You can't just go on the air and have people turn you on, because they don't, why? You know, you give them a reason. And either be funny, be informative, be a good angry white guy, you know, have them, you know, want to listen to you every day. They didn't understand that. And that's kind of why a lot of them are in trouble now. They don't really understand that you can't have a guy, you know, do a show on tape, no longer on tape, but whatever, in New York, and send it down to Horse Kiss, Arkansas, you know, and have people relate to it and just play the music. And so the local station should be able to win there, but there aren't any.
You're exactly right about that. Hey, Gary, final question here before we let you go. Is there anything you would do differently? If you look back at the on-air career, is there a moment that you wish you could have done differently?
Yeah. Gosh. I don't know where to start on that. I mean, which day are you talking? No, really. I mean, as far as my show goes, I think I got lucky and had the right people around me, and that's what made me sound way better than I was. Mm-hmm.
Well, you sounded way better for a long, long time, and we all appreciated it who lived here in Ohio and I know beyond. And like I say, that word is used very sparsely, but genius is definitely the word when you're talking about Gary Burbank. You don't get the longest syndicated show comedy-wise in radio history by just being lucky. You have to be genius, and Gary Burbank is that. And making time for us on Thanksgiving week, Gary, I cannot thank you enough. I hope you have the most wonderful holiday, and I hope we can talk again soon in the future.
Me and Einstein, both of us.
That's exactly right. Einstein and Gary Burbank are like interchangeable words.
We're geniuses. Oh, thank you for that. It's very nice of you to say that.
Thank you, Gary.
And thank you for having me on, too. And I'll be talking to you, okay?
Perfect. Thanks, Gary.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. Gary Burbank, one of a kind. Stay tuned. We got much more after the news and weather.
Radio 107.1 FM are proud to present Magnificent Marian Moments. Mary Ellen, 20th Treasurer of the United States from March the 1st,